Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to have a guest that we've had with us before, Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo. Thanks for being with us, Jennifer.
So happy to be back. Thanks for having us, Jay.
It is a very busy time right now for the Institute. I've saw some stats here about the level, the number of refugees that you helped to resettle in Buffalo during 2024. At last check, the number was going to be around 507. The expectation, though, was about 330. So why the increase?
Well, the Biden administration had really pushed to have all resettlement agencies across the nation increase the numbers because they had set a very ambitious ceiling in his last year of the presidency. And so as we got closer to the end of the year, agencies like mine that had normally been able to have the capacity of about 300-400 were asked to continue to take more and more. And we ended up almost doubling the amount that we take in. And that was with the fiscal year that just ended. This new fiscal year that started October 1, federal fiscal year, has been very, very busy. And a lot of that is politically charged because there's an anticipation that refugee resettlement may stall or cease after the inauguration.
I want to get into that for sure. But let's take a moment here. And this is something we've had you on in the past. You've done a great job with, because of your legal background, of defining the different groups, for lack of a better term, of individuals who are coming to the United States in different capacities. But what we're talking about here are refugees. Define for us what that means.
Absolutely. Refugee is a term that a lot of people hear and they figure, oh, it's somebody who fled their homeland. But it's also a legal definition that can be looked at through the lens of international law or U.S. law, and it varies. So under U.S. law, someone who has refugee status is someone who is outside of his or her own homeland, who has fled on account of persecution or a fear of future persecution on account of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, and they are unable to return home. And you actually have to go through a legal vetting process to prove that you meet that definition. Refugees that are brought into the United States with refugee status under Section 208 of the Immigration and Nationality Act are often referred to as resettlement refugees because they're coming from like a United Nations camp or a UN processing center. And they're brought through a State Department program and they're brought in with legal status and they're given employment permission to work on day one and they get an agency like ours that help them with case, like they get a caseworker. That is different from people who may show up here and say that they have a fear and they cannot return home and they've been persecuted, but they don't have refugee status. They are instead seeking asylum. And if they file for asylum, which is an application process, they become an asylum seeker. They would then have to go through that same adjudication process and meet that same definition I just talked to you about. But they would be granted that status under Section 208 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. And if they're granted it, they become an asylee. So it's the same definition, but the process upon how one seeks it and how one is granted it is different. And that's where some consternation comes in, because some people will say, well, they just showed up and now, you know, they're waiting and they're asking for help. And the folks who are seeking asylum are not automatically granted employment permission. They're not entitled to a case manager and benefits and things right away.
Yeah. And just because you did use the word, we're talking about legal. This is the individuals that you're helping to resettle here in Western New York are legally allowed into the United States with legal status. I'm keep using that word legal because I want to make sure that we define that. We can talk about asylum seekers later on and get into all that, but I want to make sure that the people that you are assisting fall into that definition.
Yes, the majority of our federal funding is for folks who have come in, refugees for resettlement, and they've already gone through that process and they've been given their legal definition. People who are seeking asylum are also availing themselves of the legal system, but they have to wait in what can sometimes be a very long line and process before they're granted legal relief.
It's always worth, I think, talking about, because it is extraordinary. People who are refugees and come to the United States, the travails they go through to get here. We could talk in general, but there's, like you said, I know your agency is dealing with a lot of folks right now. Are you hearing some of the stories of the people that are coming here and what they went through and how long it took for them to actually get a chance to come to the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, and sometimes you're really struck by it. And, you know, they don't even have to tell you their story. You can just see it in the paperwork and the documents. When you see that somebody's last address was a camp for 10 years and, you know, their child never had been in school ever and they've never gone to a dentist. And, you know, it, without even having to ask, because asking people can re-traumatize them as well. But, you know, there are people who've waited a very long time before they were able to be brought here for resettlement. And they also had no choice in the process. So, I mean, if you're choosing to leave your country and your home that you own and your family and your work and your church and all those things, and you're doing that, that's a pretty defining moment, and it's not something that someone is easily brought to do. So you've already gone through something huge that's happened to you and you must be very scared to then have to sit and wait for years and give up all control of your fate and future. You don't get to choose which country you're resettled to. It's not like you sign up and say, I'm going to the United States.
Okay, I did not know that. All right. Yep.
It's determined by the United Nations, which is determined by quotas, because every nation that participates in the Geneva Convention signs up for a capacity number. The U.S. is set by the president. So under President Biden this year, it's 125,000 refugees for resettlement. But you could very easily be assigned to France or Australia or, you know, Belgium. And if you show up at a camp with your minor children and your parents, you could be broken up as a family unit because your elderly parents may go to Belgium and you may come to the United States. And your family unit, if your daughter is in the camp for 10 years and meets somebody in the camp and they get married, they're now a new family unit and they may not come to the United States as well. So you often see family separation that can last decades, because once you get to a place like the United States, there's an expectation that you stay here, get a green card, work your way to citizenship. You're not necessarily easily able to travel, and you're not allowed to travel back to your home country, because the reason why you got that status granted to you is there was a presumed fear of persecution upon your return. So it's a lot of stories of hardship when you talk to clients.
That number of 125,000, how does that compare to other nations? Do you have an idea of that, of the scale of that?
Well, in past years, we were a larger resettler than other nations. We were seen as taking the lead. We always were doing around, 80,000, for instance, is a number that kind of stayed constant during the Bush years, during the Obama years. And so we've actually moved it up under Biden. At times, it was viewed as though we were taking the lead. But in more recent years, other countries have stepped forward. Canada has taken in far more than we have. And Europe is really to be commended because they have a humanitarian refugee crisis right on their doorstep with Ukraine. After that war started, the European Union stepped in and decided to open up access for Ukrainians within the entire EU. And so Europe at points has had up to 4 million Ukrainians moving throughout the European Union and giving them work permission to stay until they're able to return home. So there has been, from some of our partners and allies in the international space, consternation that the U.S. hasn't really moved our program forward in a bigger way.
And when it comes to people who are refugees, and this is something, since our earlier conversations, I've often reflected upon, the number of refugees who are currently refugees in the world right now sits at about what?
40 million.
40 million.
And that's just people who are registered with the United Nations as people who are outside of their homeland. That does not count the number of internally displaced individuals, because you could have conflict going on in a country like Sudan, for instance, and they're just at a different part of the country. You know, the refugee and migration crisis is not going away. Climate change is something the United Nations is very concerned about, in the sense that as land erodes and people's homelands disappear, there's going to be more stateless people. There's more conflict brewing in the world today than there was before. And all that's going on in a place where, you know, you have people who then don't have access to clean water, they don't have access to food. And then there's countries that do not want to have this displaced group. And they are, you know, warehousing them in tents and camps and saying, you're not allowed to be part of our community.
And there is a projection, isn't there, about how many refugees could be, or how many people could become refugees because of changes in the climate? Isn't there a number?
There's a projected number, I think, past like 2050. The UN has climate committees studying this, but they're looking at over 100 million.
100 million people around the globe with no place to be, no place to call home.
Yep.
So it's not going away.
It's not going away. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other currents that are happening as well, which are that some countries, including the United States, are having declining birth rates, and they actually do need workforce. And so some countries are taking advantage of that right now, and they are opening themselves up to at least have labor come in and at least temporarily do work projects. You know, an example is the World Cup that was held in recent years. You know, they actually imported workers, laborers from Malaysia and other countries to come in because they couldn't set up those stadiums fast enough. But that's something that economists are looking at right now, especially in countries that have declining birth rates, and wondering how are those economies going to continue to be successful and continue to grow their GDP if they don't have the labor force. And the U.S. is one of those countries.
And what about, let's bring it back home here for a second and just talk about the refugees that you've resettled here in terms of finding jobs. How easily, it's not easy to find a job, and no matter what, but I mean, are we finding a relatively smooth process of people finding employment?
Well, yeah, I can't speak about other parts of the United States, but I can tell you here. Buffalo, yeah, that we are able to find people jobs.
Yeah.
In the month of December alone, we've already placed 11 people in jobs. In November, we had 15 people placed in jobs. We run a job club. It's what we call it. So essentially, for every family that we resettle, we expect that one member, at least, of the household will go into our job club. It's usually the father. Sometimes it's the mother. It's an 8-week course that they go through where we teach them about the American workforce. We spend time interviewing with them and putting together a resume. Depending on their refugee journey, they may have had formal employment or maybe informal employment. They could have skills like knowing how to sew or plumbing or wire, you know, electrical work. We ascertain if they need additional education or training, because we have the ability to put them into some of those programs and pay for credentialing through some of our federal programming. But we work to get them placed in jobs. And we have a 90% success rate upon graduation of people being placed into jobs. Most people are within jobs within 6 months of their arrival here. And then it's really a conversation about what kind of job. It could be, in the beginning, a subsistence job. We place a lot of people in sort of the food service industry, hospitality, like cleaning, light industrial. But there are people who have advanced skills that are desirable in our American workforce. And then we work to see if we can get them whatever certification and training they need to be able to get into a more advanced career. So, for instance, we just recently placed somebody at Volan Electric who had electrical wire working expertise. We see a lot of mechanics, a lot of people in the finance industry, teachers, and people in the healthcare industry, where they just may need some recredentialing.
We're with Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo, an agency that is remarkably busy at this time of the year, welcoming and helping refugees resettle into Western New York right now. Talk about just some of the places that some of the recent refugees have come from.
Well, we are today resettling a lot from Burma. About half of that population is Rohingya ethnic background, but some of the other Burmese ethnic groups as well. And having a lot of Afghans coming in this year, Syrians, Congolese, that's a large population. And then a bunch of other countries as well, you know, Eritrea, Iraq, et cetera, Venezuela, Colombia. So we don't get to decide that. That's
right.
Determined for us by our national office and by quite frankly, the populations that the State Department works with the president to decide which will be prioritized for resettlement. But Buffalo is so welcoming and accessible that we aren't just getting one population. We're getting pretty much every resettlement line is coming here, and there's a community here to support them in addition to...
There's a community for every nationality that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, that's a big part of the fact that we have this history of being a community that has always welcomed immigrants, you know, for over a century. The Institute has been around since 1918. We have welcomed and helped to support and integrate every single immigrant population that has come here, starting with the Italians, which is how we were formed, you know, all the way through the immigrant waves that have happened throughout the years, you know, the Polish, the Germans, Jewish refugees after World War II, Syrians, Bosnians, Vietnamese, all the way to today's refugees. And so, you know, the community could be so established that they have a community center, like the Somali community recently bought a building and has a mural on Grant Street on their building, right, and they've established themselves. Or it could be more informal and they meet in people's houses you know, they do work in terms of welcoming the new arrivals. We have relationships with the ethnic community where if we know we have like a Congolese family coming, we will have talked to the community elders and arrange so that way they can help us prepare a hot meal. Maybe stop in on the family in the first few days after their arrival to see if they'd like to join them in church or help them go shopping. You know, there's a pay it forward type of mentality that is very Buffalo that I think all of our new arrivals are adopting.
And I think the Italian immigrants from 1918, they've done pretty fine in terms of establishing a community for themselves here in Western New York, right?
And a very fancy community center at that these days. Yes,
absolutely. I want you to, if you can, maybe put facts to what is a kind of a tale that I tell about going to Buffalo State. When I, you know, driving in from the South Towns every day back in the early 80s, going through, because I wanted to avoid the toll on the 190, because that's the way it was. But, you know, I take Plymouth Avenue up to Buffalo State, up to Forest, and take West coming back. And, you know, it was a well, you know, populated area, lots of families. It just seemed like a normal residential street. Went back there maybe 10, 15 years later, and I couldn't believe the change. A lot of places were boarded up, and it had a sense of degradation to it. Now, the West Side is a place that's booming. These same places are now being renovated and populated by, for the most part, it seems, refugees. In other words, refugees, and again, this is the anecdote that I tell, that have basically revitalized the West Side. Can you put any, can you confirm or deny what I've just said right there?
I would confirm it and say that I think the West Side is thriving. And I also see that type of renaissance happening as well in parts of the East Side now too. You know, Buffalo has affordable housing. And so it is possible to have the American dream here. You can come here and get put into an apartment that's sort of, you know, welfare rate type of rental rate and get a job and work hard and save. And then you can go out and buy a fixer-upper. And we see that happening now where communities are helping each other and they're, you know, getting themselves to build up a little bit of credit and buy a house and fix it up and have something that they own. And that means so much to somebody who had everything taken away from them. You see it in the businesses that exist today. Refugees and immigrants are very entrepreneurial. You know, there's a huge rate of business starting in people who are foreign born. And I think a big part of that is barriers to entry. It's hard to have been a doctor in Syria and then come here and be a doctor today. You'd have to go through all that schooling again. But you're a smart and educated person, and there's no reason why you can't, you know, go through and read all the licensure requirements and things and take some seed money and start a business. And so you see a lot of restaurants opening, you know, types of clothing stores. I don't know if anyone's been in Buffalo Fresh recently, the grocery market. I mean, that's amazing to go there. And if it feels like you're visiting a foreign country and there's so many amazing products that you can buy. So we're benefiting from that. Our economy, our community is benefiting not just from, you know, the growth in business, but also from the increased GDP, from the diversity, from the fact that, you know, you can dine around the world just by going into downtown Buffalo and going to the West Side and the East Side now.
Right. And it is interesting what has come out of that and how it's changed. Do you think that element is well known? I mean, you know, we most certainly just saw an election where I know this is part of the rhetoric, but I'm talking about locally. I mean, people that you deal with, people your staff deal with, do they have, are they finding that people are, Western New Yorkers are receptive and understanding of that development, or is it maybe not well known?
You know, I think it really varies. And unfortunately, so much of this gets skewered by the politics of immigration, which has become weaponized in recent campaigns. I mean, people who've interacted with refugees, you know, certainly my staff, but, you know, like people in the school system, people in the healthcare system, they can see that people are really trying hard, that they're hard workers, you know, that they want to do right for their family, that they've got this second chance. Employers in particular will rave about hiring refugees and the work ethic and, you know, the willingness to show up and stay extra and be on time and work hard. But then there's people who don't necessarily understand, or they lump everybody into this group of illegal immigrants and people who are showing up and taking. And they don't understand that that's actually not true. You know, it's, you can't just get welfare if you don't have a legal status and legal papers. You know, there may be under the table people working, but that's violating law.
Right.
It's not like people are being handed, you know, fistfuls of cash and being taken care of. That's not the case. You actually have to go through a process to be documented. And, you know, welfare is very carefully scrutinized in terms of who's entitled to it. One of the things I try when people talk about the politics of it is just to step back and, like, let's talk about facts. And so a fact that I'd like to share is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services did a study over a 15-year period on resettlement refugees and asylees, people who were granted asylum.
Okay.
And they looked at that group specifically because that's a group that money was spent on, you know, and bringing them here and having case managers at agencies like mine, and they were given welfare. And they looked at how much was spent on them and then how much did they contribute in terms of, like, working in the economy and the GDP. And what was found that over a 15-year period, there was a net fiscal impact of $124 billion.
Okay.
So they gave more, and this is after we take out what was invested in them. $124 billion is what.
So it's above and beyond any cost of.
That subtracted all the cost of the welfare and the re-credentialing and the case managers and everything. Yes.
Wow.
Once they took all that out and they looked at what they had contributed to the tax base, it was $124 billion in net income over 15 years. That wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had programs to support them and have them be in place and contributing to our economy. So, you know, years ago, the refugee program was started coming out of really World War II and the fact that there were so many people displaced who were Jewish and a recognition by, you know, the world nations that they needed to have some type of agreement about people who couldn't necessarily stay safe and had to be relocated. And so it came about as a humanitarian imperative. But really, in the last 20 years, it's been recognized that there's actually an economic incentive that makes sense for any nation that wants to bring in people who are willing to work and contribute to their economy.
Here in Western New York, so like you said, do we have any specific facts about those same type of economics for Western New York, or is it too difficult to maybe narrow that down?
Well, I can say that we can certainly point to population growth. The 2020 census, sure. You know, showed growth for Buffalo for the first time in like half a century. And it was attributed to the foreign born and to Buffalo being a large refugee resettlement hub. We are getting by far the largest number of resettlement refugees in New York State. That's including New York City. New York City has a lot of immigrants.
Okay.
People who are seeking asylum, people who are going in for all manner of immigrant visas or visitors, but they don't have refugee resettlement there in large numbers because there really aren't agencies to support it. The federal dollar is the same per person, whether it's Buffalo or Boise or New York City.
Mm.
And so, you know, affordable housing and things are, that's not words usually used in New York City, but
right.
It is used here. So it's really upstate that's shown large refugee resettlement numbers. And you see it in Buffalo in particular because there are four national pipelines coming in here. And so you see it manifest today. And if you look at those census numbers, 10% of the city of Buffalo population is foreign born. 7% of Erie County is foreign born. A big chunk of that is resettlement refugees, and it's also immigrants who are coming for skilled jobs at places like, you know, UB and Roswell and other, you know, the high tech corridor that we have here in the medical corridor.
And just to add to that, just had recorded on What's Next. It's going to be airing in the coming future from Jamestown, where 125 refugees have resettled in the last year, as a matter of fact, and are finding places to live. We're going to take a time out on What's Next. We'll come back with more. Our guest is Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo. And this is What's Next on WBFO.
This is Jack Cruiser with the scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of The Scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo, with us on What's Next this morning, talking about what has been a very busy season for her agency, helping to resettle people here in Buffalo. People have been granted refugee status of a handful, really, of the 125,000 who are coming to the United States here this year. But let's talk about the need and the help that's really needed for people to get started. I thought you did a great job of talking about the long-term benefits of having people resettle in the country and here in Western New York as well. At the same time, resettling takes a lot. If you're coming from Sudan, you're probably not ready for Buffalo winter. So what is your agency doing, and what can other people do to help out to make sure that these adjustments are as smooth as possible? And let's be honest, I think you're not from Western New York originally, you would know what it's like to first take a gasp of the Western New York winters.
We do a lot of education with clients around that. And for starters, we definitely, when we pick them up at the airport, we come ready with winter coats for everybody. We've had people come off the planes in flip-flops, so we have to immediately get boots for people. We have been asking the public for really three things: for donated goods.
Okay.
Which I can talk about, donations of cash or money, and volunteerism. Mm. And those are really the three big things we need right now, because we are having such a huge increase in arrivals. You and I can cover that later if you want, but it's unfortunately politically driven. There's been a push to send more people in before the administration changes over. And
okay.
So on our end, what we're having is, normally December is a slow month, especially with the holidays. Instead, we are resettling 19 people a week on average. Mm. So what we're doing in a week is what we usually do in a month.
Okay.
So for my staff, we are so busy, and we've had to, resettlement staff is prioritized into handling case-related, like client-related duties. And so I've had things like our communications director and our HR director doing grocery shopping for clients, or setting up and cleaning apartments.
Okay.
So that's where volunteers can help out. If you have a group of friends or a church group or even a team at your office, and you want to do a good deed, this would be a great thing to do, is contact us, because we can get you plugged into our list of opportunities. And setting up an apartment takes about 2 to 3 hours. We source the inventory, and then you would be moving it there, cleaning the apartment, and getting it set up to look very homey and welcoming to somebody who is going to be arriving and probably never had a home of their own for the last several years, if not decades. Mm. So in terms of donated goods that we're looking for, if you're outfitting somebody who's showing up here off a plane from a place like Sudan, they probably have some clothes, and it's probably not winter gear. They're not going to have anything else. So everything that you need to go into an apartment, we obviously have to provide the bare minimum that's required. We try to go above and beyond that. So we're talking about, housewares, plates, silverware, things like that. bedding. Some things we do ask that people purchase new.
Okay.
You know, nobody really wants used bedding or used mattress. So we do buy things new with the money that we're given by the government. But today, in terms of things we're looking for on our list, it's always on our website, iibuffalo.org. There's our wish list. You can either see what we're looking for and drop it off, or you can actually purchase it through, like, we have an Amazon wish list already set up. Today, in particular, we're looking for men's medium-sized winter coats.
Okay.
Also, brand new would be car seats, booster seats, diapers. Those are the kinds of things that taking used is, obviously, we can't take a used diaper, but a used car seat, also not the easiest because it could have a recall on it or whatever. Looking for garbage cans, pillows, tea kettles. Visa gift cards are also very helpful, too, because then we can just go out and buy what people need. But, you know, it's everything from making sure that the kitchen has enough, you know, dishware in it, and there's enough towels and the bare amount of furniture that you need, like a couch and beds, to making sure there's, you know, shovels and salt and, you know, the type of things you would need to get through the winter months here. So it's a heavy lift to set up each apartment. And there have been so many arrivals that, for instance, the week after Thanksgiving, we had 7 families arrive that week. And so that's where we were in overdrive, and we had done a big plea out to the public to ask for donated goods, and people did respond. I mean, we probably
Great to hear. Yep.
We've probably gotten, I think it's over $10,000 worth of donated goods in the last 2 weeks, which has been very helpful. Because that then allows us to save the client money we're given. There's only so much from the government per person. We try to save that to pay for security deposits, and bus passes and first month's rent. Because after that, people need to get into Job Club and get a job and start paying for themselves.
So, yeah, it sounds like a frantic time in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I think you said it is a time where also there's some real appreciation, I'm sure, from people who are coming here for the first time.
I mean, people feel very welcomed, and they're always, you know, overwhelmed at the welcome that they're getting. I mean, I can't even imagine what they're thinking, leaving a camp, getting on a plane for the first time and coming here. But, you know, all those little touches make a difference. And so when you see a volunteer group that comes in and, you know, they scrub a house that, you know, was a rough looking apartment, and they make it look nice, and then they hang up some, you know, they come bring stuff from home. They bring some old curtains and hang up some artwork, and they leave a nice note. I mean, for a family walking into that, you know, that's their first home. That's where their kids are going to finally sleep and call home. They can unpack the suitcase that has maybe 20 of their belongings total and put them in a dresser and know that no one's going to take that from them. And that's a very big thing. And we see clients oftentimes overwhelmed at the fact that not only do they have a permanency here, but that people went out of their way to make them feel welcome.
And I know the listeners of WBFO are tremendously generous individuals. And if they, like you said, if they wanted to find a way to get involved in helping out, iibuffalo.org. And also, we also mentioned during the break, there's also a page there. We're talking about the value of refugees, the value of immigrants. There's a page also at the website that kind of goes through all those statistics, right?
Yes, it's called Know the Value. Mm-hmm. We've been embarking on that as sort of a communications and education series. Big part of our mission is about educating people and learning learning the value of immigrants and refugees and what they bring to our community and how it's beneficial for everybody.
Let's talk now about this. What's coming? It's busy right now. What could happen on January 20th when the inauguration of the next president, President Donald Trump, of course, we all know that was president as well from 2016 through 2020, will be the new man and head of the administration. What's possible?
Well, we are hopeful that refugee resettlement will continue. But, you know, looking at and listening to what has been said on the campaign trail, there is a very big fear that there will be a suspension of the refugee resettlement program that's operated by the State Department, which would mean no new arrivals for clients of ours. And also potential travel bans, which happened during the first Trump administration. We're anticipating that could also happen again. And then there's also been a lot of political rhetoric around deportations. And so, you know, there's a great fear in our community about how this is going to impact clients and the services that we can provide and the overall tone that could take over in our community.
Let's just talk about refugees, though. So Did the Trump's administration first time around, did he end the refugee resettlement?
He didn't end it, but it was suspended for 4 months.
Okay.
Which meant that there were no arrivals coming in for 4 months. That may sound minor, but for nonprofits like ours, if there are no new arrivals, that means that our funding stops. Mm. So it, what ends up doing is there's a waterfall effect where we do have money that comes related to arrivals. And if the money, if the arrivals stop, the money stops. And then we end up like into a series of, you know, we'd have to do cutbacks and layoffs and things like that. And so during the first administration of Trump, over 100 resettlement agencies ended up closing their doors entirely. No agencies in New York State closed. That was largely due to the fact that we have some other revenue streams and our state legislature stepped in and created some protected funding in the state budget to float to the upstate resettlement agencies. But across the country, over 100 agencies closed their doors over the course of 4 years because the federal funding had really been drastically cut.
It's one thing to talk on the campaign trail and to issue rhetoric and, you know, that wins campaigns, doesn't it? But at the same time, you know, in the issue of governance, you know, there are, we've sat here for the last half hour talking about the benefits to the United States, to Western New York for of having refugees here. I mean, is there a sense that this administration that there might be, you know, the billboard message, but yet underneath an effort to continue to govern and govern responsibly?
I'm not sure. I don't know what this administration will do coming in. I listen to what people say. And, you know, we operate a business at the end of the day. And you know, we are responsible for the clients that we serve as well as, you know, the staff that we employ. And so we're trying to be conservative about how we spend money and anticipate and wait and see. We want to make sure that people still feel that they can be served. And we want to make sure people feel safe in our community and welcomed.
Making people feel safe in the community. That sounds like something that, you know, obviously your agency is going to do what it can, but again, this, even maybe not even a volunteer effort, but for lack of a better term, an advocacy effort when it comes to that. I mean, that's, I think, no matter who you are and no matter what your stance is on this type of issue, you'd want everybody in our community to be safe.
I'd hope so. I'd hope that that would be a very, you know, good neighborly Buffalo sentiment. I don't know if that's what everybody feels, but, you know, welcoming means somebody feels that they belong and that they're able to access their community however they need to. So it means, you know, if your kids are in school, that you're able to access an interpreter if you're having a parent-teacher conference. If you're going into an emergency room, that there's the ability to have an interpreter, you know, brought up on the phone if you need to ask for help. It means, you know, police force wanting to serve you and make sure that, you know, your needs are being addressed and not just, you know, assuming you're illegal and calling immigration. You know, there's a host of things that come into welcoming and supporting people in our community. And so when an overall rhetoric takes place about not wanting the bad people here, you know, that's, unless people take the time to be educated, you know, you could just make assumptions that are not correct about what someone's legal status is and if they're allowed to be here. And the concern that immigration advocates are making, you know, on the national level is when there's talk of deportation raids and swooping people up, is that a lot of people who are not appropriate to be swept up into that may get swept up into that. You know, children who are U.S. citizens or people who have legal status who happen to be at a community center with people who don't have legal status. I mean, it's just all that language increases the level of concern and fear and worry. And we're already getting calls from clients that are worried about if they could be arrested or if they could be sent back home, worrying about if the family members that are still waiting to come, if they'll be able to come. There's just, right now, I think we're just starting with that worry and concern. I'm anticipating that after inauguration, if the promises that have been made are acted upon, I'm anticipating that we're going to have a lot of panic and we're getting a lot of phone calls that we may be needing to do some type of information sessions with clients.
I want to get into that, and we're going to get into that when we come back. We're going to take one more break and come back with Jennifer Rizzo Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo. This is What's Next on WBFO.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, Listen to WBFO The Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on WBFO 88.7 or your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next. We are talking this morning with Jennifer Rizzo-Choi, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo. They have been incredibly busy helping to resettle new Western New Yorkers, refugees who have gone through the process of and the very lengthy and arduous and quite frankly, from you know my own perspective, an almost unbelievable process to become to get status to come to the United States and to come here to Western New York. At the same time, we're kind of looking forward, projecting forward here to following the rhetoric to a certain extent of what could be coming during the Trump administration. Let's talk about that. And you touched on this as we're going to the break, this concept of mass deportation, that this is going to be the largest deportation in the history of the United States. Let's first of all just talk about, you kind of were touching on it, I want to expand a little bit about what you think is possible and what could be maybe the unforeseen tragedies that might come along with that.
Well, the words mass deportation have been used a lot on the campaign trail.
Certainly.
And what I'd say, first of all, is that, enforcing that and enacting that is not an easy thing at all. If there's a priority on day one, as I've read in newspaper articles, to round up immigrants that are undocumented, I assume that means they're going to be going to locations where there are undocumented immigrants. So for one, they'll probably go to some of these shelters that were set up. A lot of those are hotels and things like that. They may also go to workplaces or stores. And so while you may have people there who are undocumented, I'd say number one, some of them are probably in the process of a court system where they're seeking asylum. So there's legal rights that you'd be trampling on. Number two, there's probably also people there who are legal. They could have children who were born here. There could be community members, church members who are visiting to provide service or help. You know, that could be my employees there. You know, we employ people who are foreign born who have legal status. So a large swoop in of everybody is going to sweep up a whole bunch of people who are not out of status and who could end up in a court system or detained for a period of time until matters can be sorted out. And that's just going to cause mass hysteria, number one. Number two, deporting people is not like this quick, efficient thing where, you know, oh, we don't have papers. We're putting you on a plane today. It doesn't work that way. A lot of countries won't accept a deport plane until they've authenticated every single person on that plane and confirmed that that person belongs to their country. And not everybody's walking around with their documents on them, or not everybody, quite frankly, has documents of their own homeland.
Right.
People who are seeking status in another country, part of them fleeing that country was because maybe they weren't welcomed there or they were being persecuted. It's not unheard of. I'm an immigration lawyer. I've met many clients who never had documents because they were born stateless. There's a right just being born in this state. And by the mere fact that you're born in a hospital in New York State, you're given a birth certificate. That's a document that I've had many clients over the years that never had. Mm. They were just never given a record of their birth. Sometimes I meet clients and they can't even tell me when they were born. It was the year of the burnt corn. I'll get like that type of answer.
Wow.
If they were born in a place that was so rural or in a country that didn't want them there as a refugee population. So point being, there's a lot of messiness with trying to ascertain, you know, who is what and what their status is and were they already in court or not and do they have a pending asylum case or not. So it's not like on day one, you're going to be able to just get a whole bunch of people and put them on a plane. I think what's going to happen on days 2, 3, and 4 is that there'll be a bunch of detention facilities or holding centers established that I understand are already being constructed, and that people maybe move to those facilities while they have government individuals come in and try to sort through paperwork and processes. So, you know, I what I'm concerned about is a lot of confusion. As a lawyer, I'm worried about the trampling of rights and the abrogation of justice. You know, we have protections in place in this country that adhere to our promises within international law and the Geneva Conventions to honor people and allow them to go through a process to see if they would qualify to stay. A lot of people won't qualify for asylum to stay. It's actually a very hard standard to meet,
right.
But they are and they should be entitled to that day in court in that process. And a big part of what's gone on in this conflict over the years is the fact that the process has taken a long time because the system hasn't been serviced. And you're looking at people who have waited 3 or 4 years for a court date.
Mm.
And those are people that they're following the process, and yet there's anger now, and there's a wish to want to deport those people. But that would be a trampling of rights that are guaranteed to people under our Constitution.
How are you advising people who have resettled here recently, or you're still involved with? What would be your advice, I guess, to anybody who falls into any of these kind of circumstances that we just talked about?
Well, the advice varies based on the person and their situation. And so, I mean, I'd say generally as a blanket, if you are somebody who is an immigrant and you're concerned about your status or what could happen, I think you should do a consultation with an immigration lawyer. You know, there's agencies in town that have immigration lawyers. We have a very small legal team, so we've been advising people that talk to us. But everybody's situation's different,
okay,
depending on what your status is and quite frankly, what your nationality is, because there's been statements made by the Trump campaign about wanting to revoke, you know, for instance, Ukrainian parole and end the, you know, protections for Afghans. So it would vary depending on, you know, who you are and the manner in which you came here. But I would say, generally speaking, you know, try to get a legal consult, try to go to an information session if one of the area nonprofits is holding those. Try to stay out of trouble and not draw attention to yourself, you know, while we sort of wait and see. My hope is that a lot of this was rhetoric.
Sure.
And that
something to win a campaign.
Yep. And that, you know, there will be a more orderly and you know, thought out process for how to handle the immigration problem that this country has. Because the immigration problem that this country has been decades in the making, and it's not solvable with just mass deportations. Every country wants to get rid of the bad actors. And that's no different for us. And that has happened over the years. I mean, Obama was actually referred to as the deporter in chief.
Right.
He deported more people than President Biden did. He had a targeted approach at the time about trying to get rid of people who had criminal records and, you know, traffickers, terrorists, like that was a targeted approach. And when other people were encountered in the immigration system, they exercised something called prosecutorial discretion, where they said, look, you're out of status, you know, but you have no criminal record. And it sounds like you have a job and, you know, you have a family. And so we're not going to calendar you for a new court date. We're going to move forward and focus our time on people who have, you know, violations and that we want to execute on removing. That was the approach, and that Obama's team was successful in that. And during his term, you know, looking at something like that is a more targeted approach to getting rid of the bad actors, and then looking at those who are here still and examining what are our preferences here. If you have U.S. ties, if you have U.S. born children, if you are at an employer that's relying upon your labor, there are a lot of employers that are concerned about losing their workforce.
Right.
If they are suddenly deported, there has to be a more intelligent conversation about what to do about like these different groups of people, and not just throwing them all under one big category. And a big part of it as well is looking at the immigration system as a whole and understanding that you can't wait 4 years to give somebody an answer.
Right.
You know, there's millions of cases that are currently in the immigration court docket right now.
Millions.
I printed out something from Track Immigration, which is a data tracking tool run by Syracuse University. They do massive FOIAs of government immigration systems. And as of the end of September of 2024, there was 1.8 million new court cases in the immigration court system. That's an insane number when you also consider the fact that there's a backlog in addition to that 1.8 I just talked about. There's a backlog of 3.7 million cases in the immigration court system that stretches back years.
And you mentioned, you said this is years in the making, this we call it an immigration problem. I think that some people would say I'm soft selling it. I'll just call it an immigration problem. And the idea that over the decades, and we're talking decades, right? You know, economies across the country, even here in Western New York, you know, the agriculture economy, California, have been benefiting or moving forward, I would say, with people who probably, you know, were long before any of this rhetoric emerged. Is it just a matter of, you know, not funding, not building the apparatus, not building the governmental and administrative infrastructure that needed that could maybe made this all much more orderly and not have this problem right now?
That's a part of it. It's a big part of it. It's also about having a reckoning about realizing that there's been, over the course of like even the last decade, at least 10 million people here who are considered undocumented,
okay,
where they either had no status or they lapsed in status, like they came on a visa and then overstayed. And what do you want to do with those people? And because of the political arguments back and forth, nothing has been done. So those people, though, exist in our economy. They work. They're doing a lot of those jobs you just referenced. And, you know, a city like New York City, you know, if they were actually able to effectuate a mass deportation, there would be no restaurants operating.
Mm.
Realistically, who's going to be washing the dishes and you know, doing food prep if all of the people who are undocumented are suddenly deported? So there needs to be a conversation about that, too. The last real, quote, amnesty happened decades ago, and it was about 3 million people who had been here as an overstay or undocumented and were allowed to stay. And so that the political will has not been here for that since then, and that needs to be looked at now. Of the 11 million people that is estimated by the census to be undocumented, another key number I like to talk about is that it's also estimated that about 6 million of those people have households that are mixed status, as in there's U.S. citizen or green card holding spouses or children. So you're looking at ripping apart a lot of families because there's an undocumented individual in that household. So that's another piece of it, too, where it's not just repairing the law and the system, but that needs to be done. It's also about looking at the larger group of people who've been here a long time. And do you want to be able to transition them into a permanent status here? What does it take or what does it mean to be American? And then there's also a conversation that needs to be had about our economy and our labor force and what is needed to actually do the jobs that people who are doing under the table right now.
And the number that we heard was, what, 3 million people in the mass deportation? So it's safe to say if 3 million people were deported, let's say you go back to your original thought, this can't happen overnight, but if it did happen overnight, it would be a blow to the economy.
It'd be a blow to the economy. It'd rip apart families. You know, 3 million is what's sort of docketed currently in the immigration court system. That's who has been, you know, caught or has gone and has been encountered.
Hmm.
But I've read articles that have said that the Trump administration is anticipating or they have aspirations to deport up to 20 million people. That's more than the census targeted number of 11 million that's undocumented. So when we say who's going to be swept up into this, I'm not sure who that is. Are we talking about a whole bunch of kids that were born here? Are we talking about, you know, family members who have legal status? Are we talking about refugees who have status but don't speak English and are misunderstood as to what their status is? That's this whole chilling effect about talking about this in that way. And it's not American, in my opinion. It's, you know, this country's been for centuries built upon people who came here and tried hard and became part of being this country and being an American. And I think this takes us pretty backward if we're talking about just sending all these people away without giving them the due process and hearing them out and thinking through who we want in this country.
You know, Jennifer, you just actually kind of, I think you just answered what was going to be my final question, which is a kind of a final plea or of sorts or a final statement regarding this. So let's just bring it back to Western New York. We've got about a minute to go. What can people do in Western New York? Let's just talk about the people who are coming here, refugees who are coming here, and they're coming here fast and at a pretty hectic rate for your staff. But what can people do right now?
If people want to help out, they can, of course, volunteer with us. They can donate goods or money. I would ask even that they just educate themselves by listening to a program like this or going on our website or learning more and having conversations with family members and friends who may be misinformed to understand that this is not a soundbite answer, a soundbite, you know, description of something, that it's more nuanced and there's more that it's taken to understand the topic, to realize what it means for not only our community, but about our country and what it means to be welcoming.
And a question I asked frequently, I think in the early days of this program, of people, I'll let other people find out about the early days and the origins of this program, but are you hopeful?
I always have to be hopeful because I am grateful to be American, and I see what freedom means every day in the eyes of our clients. Mm. So I know that I'm lucky to have been born here, to have the fortune of having been born here. And I think that's what we are about. And I think that this is just a chapter of some, you know, tension and confusion. And I'm hoping that we will move past this. So I think America is a great place, and that's why people still want to come here. We just need to think through and have some better solutions.
Jennifer Rizzo Choi, as always, thanks very much for joining us on What's Next.
Thank you for having us.
You can find out more at iibuffalo.org about all the issues that we had right here or discussed. And obviously, there's a lot more to it. And get yourself educated. Find out for yourself your own answers. Jennifer Rizzo Choi is the executive director of the International Institute of Buffalo. This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.